Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 23rd, 2001. In the fireside room is Jan Keeson.
Talking about young men and fire. To begin with, I can tell you a little bit about McLean. He, as you know, grew up in Montana, right near the Seeley Lake area, which is very close to Missoula. When he was a young man, his father homeschooled him very rigorously until the truant officer caught up with him. I think he was about 12. We have Shelley's here too. He was about 12 years old, but before that, his father had this very rigorous program for him for studies. He was a Scots Presbyterian minister. But anyway, in the afternoon, McLean was free to run in the woods and kind of find his own way. His father told him that he was saving enough money for McLean to go to any school he could get into. So he decided, I've forgotten why, to go to Dartmouth. So anyway, went over to the Eastern Seaboard there. It was his first opportunity with people outside of the Montana area. Hi, come on in. Tell us your names. That's okay. Okay. And you are?
Jean.
Why don't you come up here a little bit, because it's a smaller group.
Well, sit back here.
Okay. All right. But anyway, we're talking about McLean as a young man. So his father, being the Scots Presbyterian minister, and pretty rather parsimonious in terms of money. So McLean was able to get into Dartmouth College as a young man. So he went there in the Eastern Seaboard, and he had this experience very different from people in Montana. So while they did, I don't know what people in the Eastern Seaboard do since I'm from the Midwest, but they did their typical, I would say city, maybe even suburban things when they went back. They had these jobs. McLean would come back and he'd saw wood. And it was also during the time that men were fighting in World War I. When he was about 15 years old, this happened. World War I was going on. So Montana had a quota of men that they had to give to the war. So that took all of the men out of the woods. Hi there.
Hi.
Tell us your name.
Dave.
Dave. We're talking about McLean's earlier life. So anyway, at the age of 15, he started working in logging. And folks, this wasn't the era when we had chainsaws. I mean, if you go up to the copper mining there and you look in the museum, you'll see one of these big band saws that they have, and it takes two people. And, you don't want to chop any of the trees down here, but just to see what this is like. I mean, you two guys look like, you look like you can handle a saw, but that is tough work. Just look behind you and see one of these pieces of wood. You try and manage one of those saws. And they were paid in terms of board fee. Hi there.
Hi.
So it was hard, rigorous work. And some of the, when he went back from Dartmouth, most of these kids had rather simple jobs, and McLean would be out there sawing all summer long. And they were paid in board fee, and it depended a lot on what kind of a partner you had. So if you read this book, I don't know if you've read any of the stories, I'm going to just talk about the novel mainly, but if you read in the stories in the back here about your pal Jim, or the cook and a hole in the sky, let's see, what's the other one? Yeah, your pal Jim. If you haven't read that, you should, because he has this guy that looks like, he's big trouble. And he, for some reason, chooses McLean to saw this wood. And, oh man, McLean is really afraid he can't hold up his end, or this guy will probably saw him in half. So these guys, you didn't mess around with them. And they worked very, very hard. And also, if you didn't have a good dinner, like we have good dinners at Holden, these lumberjacks who had these special shoes with spikes in them to climb up the trees, I mean, there was one instance in one of these stories where they actually got up on the table and with their boots, you know, just walked over what the cook had set and was trying to feed them. And the implication was that the cook would be the next person they were going to walk over if they didn't have a better dinner. So the cook was always on tenterhooks. But anyway, he grew up in that kind of, you know, really rough element. And so he'd go to Dartmouth, which is kind of a civil place, and then he saw wood, and then he'd go back in the fall in Dartmouth, and that's how he worked his way through Dartmouth. And then he wound up at the University of Chicago working on a doctorate and teaching, as a lot of us do, you know, as assistants or so while we're working on a doctorate. So anyway, that's how he came to Chicago. He was always a maverick, as you may imagine, at Chicago. Most of the profs, even in those earlier days, had long resumes where they had all kinds of credentials where they published this. To this day, if you look at what McLean published, it ain't much, folks. And he would say that while the rest of his effete colleagues were going to Europe to study, you know, in the museums or the universities there, and in McLean's acetetermin had pigeon shit on them, he would come back to Seeley Lake and live in a cabin that he and his father built. But that's the heritage, and there was just a real clash of cultures with him and, you know, Dartmouth and certainly Chicago too. So why would they have a guy like that there? Well, one of the reasons they had him there was he was an absolutely fabulous teacher. He had this way in class of just engaging everybody and having everybody just sitting on the edges of their chairs. And plus, he was a very rigorous professor. I mean, if you didn't do your work, chances are you'd be, you know, really embarrassed in class. So, but he won the most prestigious teaching award at the University of Chicago for his teaching. When he was also, because he won that award, he was asked to give a talk. In that talk, he defined a good teacher as a tough guy who cares deeply about something that is hard to understand. A tough guy who cares deeply about something that is hard to understand. And every time I start new classes, I think of that. One of the things this tough guy wrote on a student paper is this. This was found in his papers after he had died. Your writing is very poor. However, it is quite adequate to express your paltry thoughts. So, if you want to learn, he was there to teach you, but boy, if you didn't, if you were a laggard, he had no use for you. So they told me that they loved and hated McLean, the profs and at the school and so on. So how did he get to write A River Runs Through It? How does a guy like that write A River Runs Through It? Well, as the intro in here tells you, he told these stories to his children, but what really happened, and these folks are still alive and can tell you about this, but that in Chicago's history, early on, well, they still have a place called the Quadrangles Club, and now it's integrated, you know, you can have both men and women in there. But in McLean's day, but to this day they tell me you can't come to the Quadrangles Club, you can't buy your way into this club, you have to be invited, so I don't know. I've been in there a couple times and it didn't seem to be, I don't think that they'd arrest you if you'd walk in there and order something to eat or stay overnight. But anyway, years ago, these guys would get together and they'd swap papers or they'd present on different topics, okay? It was kind of a guy's thing. And some really interesting characters would do that. And they were, one of them was David Bevington, who is still at Chicago, he teaches Shakespeare. Wayne Booth, who probably all of you have heard of, even if, you know, you're not in the English field. John Cowalty, Dr. Gerald Drew, they were all doctors. Gwynne Kolb, who is still alive. Kenneth Norcott and Ned Rosenheim, who was also still alive, but they were people there that when I was at Chicago, they were kind of the grandfatherly, older gentlemanly scholars, and I was lucky enough that they taught me. When it was McLean's turn to present to this group, it says it here, the secretary of this scholarly club, which I belong to, telephoned to tell me it was my turn to give the paper at the next meeting. The club called itself the Stochastics, in his terms, the thinkers. And originally they were all biologists. These guys aren't all biologists, the ones I just read. However, in keeping with recent cultural changes, have taken in a certain number of humanists and social scientists. On the whole, the experiment proved successful, since no distinction can be observed among these different social classes in the amount they drink before and during dinner and during the scientific and scholarly speeches that follow. So now we're a lot more careful about what we drink. And most academics that I know their wines, but they don't know bourbon or whatever else that these guys are drinking, scotch, whiskey probably. But anyway, they would have a rousing good time. So he was asked the title of his speech, and on the card he put logging and pimping. Where it says speaker put down Norman McLean, noted authority. Finally, I could hear breathing over the telephone, so to aid in the process of resuscitation, I added, it's a scholarly work, as scholars say, a genuine contribution to knowledge. So anyway, this is how this book started. He started reading stories about the West and about his experiences in Seeley Lake, which were dramatically different than what anybody else was doing there at that time. He didn't begin writing this until he was 70 years old, when his wife Jessie died. So there's hope for all of us who still struggle with writing. But anyway, this is what came out of it. And one of the rubrics I've been talking about, some of you are new, is what makes great literature. And just quickly, by way of review, since some of you are repeaters here, I should probably ask you, newcomers, what is it that just, what do you love about a book? What's the best book you read and what do you love about it? We'll talk about that for about 5 minutes.
Good characters.
All right, they have to have good characters. Can you think of a book that you love?
Angle of Repose.
Angle of Repose. And what a fitting thing to bring up, huh, here? Yes, so tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's Wallsteiner. And it's set in California mostly.
Uh-huh.
And it leads with a gentleman who's elderly in a wheelchair and infirm.
Yeah.
And he flashes back to his life and his relationship. I think it's his relationship with his wife. I haven't read it in a while.
And his granddaughter and some of his children too, right? Yeah, okay. So we're talking about Art Stegner. One of your criteria is character. I don't know how many of these things work. All right, we'll try orange. Somebody you can identify with. So that's what you would say in this angle of repose. Dawn, what about you? What was yours?
Joy Luck Club.
Oh, that's right. Okay. And so you would say characters and something kind of unusual that you hadn't read before, some culture.
Yeah.
How about you guys?
The last book I read was, I can't remember the author, but it was an English woman. The title was Once in a House on Fire.
Okay.
And I don't think it's available in the U.S. I picked it up at Heathrow.
Okay. And what was good about it?
Well, it wasn't a novel, really, but it was kind of a memoir about a woman, her growing up and incredible circumstances she lived in and how she had her own father died when she was very young, and then she went through a succession of stepfathers who were pretty downright nasty, I guess. Through all of this, she ended up going to university and so forth.
So what is this, like a rags to riches story?
Pardon?
What appeals to Jeff about this story?
Well, I guess it was the fact that it actually happened, and she wrote about it well.
Okay. So I something with maybe events, and you said she wrote about it well. Okay, Kathy, how about you? I'm sorry. Barb. You can't, okay.
But for the one that he read was kind of survival of the human spirit.
Okay. So it's something that in some ways that is uplifting or engages our energy. All right. Anybody have any other? Some of you are. One of you guys,
I'm really impressed with this.
Oh, that's Michael cool. Cunningham's The Owls.
An incredible time.
What do you love about it, Lori?
The writing is outstanding. Yeah. It's poetry, a lot of it. But
okay, so we're talking about the quality of writing again.
These things work. And the story's extremely multi-layered.
Okay.
So, he keeps shifting perspective, and you keep seeing something new.
Okay. It is. And incidentally, it's one of the first pieces of fiction that, at least I've read, where a gay person is a protagonist.
Yeah.
And you get to see some of the struggles that he is going through.
Yeah.
Have you read Mrs. Dalloway?
I have for a long time.
See, because it's very much in it. If you reread Dalloway and you see that, it's just very, very artful, what he's done here. It's just remarkable.
Yeah, I can.
Yeah. It's a good book. I thought it was a great read.
How about history and adventure?
Okay.
And poetry.
All right.
The Long Ships.
The Long Ships. Jeez. Okay. I don't know that one. Tell us about it.
Who's the author, Dave?
It's a Swedish author. I forget. I read it a long time ago. Too.
Is it fiction?
No, it's a historical novel.
Yeah, it's
historical novel.
It's historical about the Vikings.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
And
what's the name of this? Because, nothing else.
The Long Ships.
The Long Ships.
It's now required, I think I've heard it. It's required reading in Sweden.
Wow.
It has true events that happen, battles, and gives the history of how the Vikings made the transition from pagans to Christians.
Set right at the end of the period, millennium.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's very poetic throughout the entire book.
So you're talking again. A lot of you brought up the fact that you love language in books. Something that matters to you. Okay, Gabe, did you want to say anything?
Dave. Yeah.
You're Dave. I was thinking that guy up there. But go ahead.
Okay, I thought you said Dave or Gabe.
Okay, but Dick. All right, do it.
You're looking this way. I didn't.
Yeah, that's okay. Anybody can jump in.
I like books that are mind expanding.
Uh huh.
And there's a book called I can't think of it. Had it a second ago. It's about physics and
was Einstein's Dream or was
that's okay. Part of they talk about Einstein's. I just finished one. It's called The Beautiful Universe or the Incredible Universe by a guy named Michael Green.
Okay. And so what you like is something that challenges your mind, gets you thinking in an artful way.
Just helps maybe explain or to take you to a completely different level of thinking about things. So.
Okay. Whitey?
I have a question of you.
Okay.
In your experiences, do you find that men seem to generally I would say nonfiction, but I mean, factual material, physics, I'll read a math book and physics books or anything, I don't care what it is, just so it is the opposite of brothers care myself, in other words, I go to the brothers and I love the description and all that, or War and Peace, that's what But that's left in college. I'm not interested in it anymore. I mean, I'll read something that absolutely, certainly is nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I don't care what it is. It doesn't matter how to smell popper. I don't care.
That's an interesting question. You mean these whole gender issues?
I just want it to be true that men are generally.
Yeah, I think there are guys' books. Definitely. And I think McLean definitely is one of them. I mean, women don't exactly like to see, you know, a whore. They think of a woman who's, you know, who has no other recourses, and that's what she's forced to do, and then they kick her. You know, this is not something that women are going to take too kindly, but guys understand this kind of stuff, right? And Young Men in Fire is more of a guy's book, too. But you're asking about nonfiction or fiction readers. I don't know the answer, and that's a whole other conversation. But what is happening in my discipline is I have far more women students than I do men now. So, and I think you see, you know, when I was going to school at Chicago, there were a lot of guys who had careers in English and in writing. That in fact, they dominated the career of the discipline, but that's changed dramatically now. So I think that you're getting more and more integration in the disciplines, but as far as reading is concerned, I don't know quite the answer. I have some suspicions, but and I'll ponder that. I wish I could give you a better answer. Maybe you could puzzle that out too. Anybody?
As a librarian, I kind of watch what people check out, and I think the impression is, and the facts are, that nonfiction is more circulated to men.
Okay, see, there's your answer.
And especially men in the 30 to 50, we plot it by decade of age, and that's often true. Young men will read some fiction, there's not much written for teens, but they will read what's there. And then I find that the older men will read some of the fiction. At least in our community. Then I'm the opposite because I prefer nonfiction.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
It just depends. But anyway, just Dave, did you want to say anything? Or?
Yeah, as far as what I look for down there, I really look for an eclectic voice in I'm reading. And that comes out in this Dennis Johnson guy that I like to read.
Yeah.
He has a very dry, satirical kind of sense of humor. I think it comes out in McLean, too, because I identify with the childhood that he describes. And furthermore, I just like, with the eclectic voice, what appeals to me is the sort of storytelling mode that they get into. I like to read Steinbeck a lot, too.
Yeah.
But I'm more interested in hearing what you have to say about the McLean here.
Okay, I'll tell you that in just a moment, but since I've been talking about what makes a great book, just quickly, these are the criteria that we have been experimenting with, and you can either disagree or, but it's a starting point for us, and then we'll talk more about McLean. The first criteria that I can think of is something that fires your soul. It's the, wow, you've got to read this book factor, okay? So that's the first one. The second one is something with a character who comes alive, the central character who comes alive. The third is something beautiful in terms of how it's written. And I'll read you in a moment some examples of some beautiful literature in terms of rhythm, word choice, diction, tension between the choices of the words. So that has something to do with that's beautiful. The fourth is something of ethical significance, something that we care deeply about. And the fifth one is something we want to return to. I was just talking with some folks a moment ago. We were talking about the great books. I knew a general who retired from the Air Force who said, I'm reading all the great books. I read them all in a year. And at first I was so impressed, but now I'm really suspicious. It's like saying, you know, I listen to all Beethoven's symphonies, and now I know, you know? Yeah, maybe. But anyway, those are the criteria. So, is this a great book? This guy was 70 years old. He started writing then. listen to the rhythm and the language. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of Great Trout Rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John, the favorite, was a dry fly fisherman. So, if you're like me, you're hooked on it. And I don't even know a whole lot about fly fishing. But what to me is so interesting in this is it just seems so simply written, so simply rendered. And yet there are, the more you get into this, the more you see that with this simplicity, there are some beautiful layers of meaning at work. And in terms of form relating to meaning in a great work, it's very much like going to a mountain stream out there and you see, say you're going to land your fly, and you see something on the surface. But you know underneath there are a whole lot of other things going on. And that's the beauty of this book. So I could show you some examples of that. Let me get my notes out, how this works. And from a rhetorical standpoint, too, that would be subject for somebody like Gage for a whole other conversation, how you write. There are stress positions in a sentence in terms of the rhythm. I'll give you a quick example. I'm on a diet, but I love a piece of chocolate cheesecake. Or, I love a piece of chocolate cheesecake, but I'm on a diet. Said the same thing, but you know from the stress position, I'm sure you'd all agree, I'm on a diet, but I love a piece of chocolate cheesecake. I'm going to take it. I love a piece of chocolate cheesecake and a sentence, but I'm on a diet where your stress position is. You're not going to take it. So he knows this. I mean, there are ways you can look at this in terms of stress positions and rhythm and what he says. But it just, we know at reading this, it's just beautiful how he sets this up. So you have even the use of the word line, there is no clear line. You know, in terms of diction choices, it's just perfect because fly fishing has lines too. And metaphorically, it's not like he's hitting you over the head with this metaphor. It's just so artfully rendered. So anyway, he sets that up. And what is the chief end of man? And we answered together so one of us could carry on if the other forgot. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. This always seemed to satisfy him, as indeed such a beautiful answer should have. And besides, he was anxious to be on the hills where he could restore his soul and be filled again to overflowing for the evening sermon. His chief way of recharging himself was to recite to us from the sermon that was coming, enriched here and there with selections from the most sacred, successful passages of his morning sermon, and so on. So anyway, you're kind of walking with him, and he's kind of letting you into what's happening. Immediately he gets into fly fishing. So you can see how beautifully this is integrated in the text. Even so, in a typical week of our childhood, Paul and I probably received as many hours of instruction in fly fishing as we did in all other spiritual matters. After my brother and I became good fishermen, we realized that our father was not a great fly caster. But he was accurate and stylish and wore a glove on his casting hand. As he buttoned his glove in preparation to giving us a lesson, he would say, "It's an art that is performed in a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock." Now, aren't there any fly fishermen here? Faye does a little bit of it, and Whitey, all right. So, do you, show me, get up here and show me how this goes. Okay, you go back first, yes. Okay, and then, go ahead.
And then you throw it forward.
Okay. Now, is it, you have to do this more than once, don't you?
Yes, and then every time you pull back, you you're pulling line out of your reel.
Yeah.
And then you throw it again, and it gets out a little bit farther, and so all you right. reach the point you're trying to find.
Okay. So, but according to McLean, there's a definite four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock, and it's closer to 12 than it is to 2. Do you agree with that?
Yeah,
I do. Yeah? Okay.
It depends on how you learn. My dad was a fly fisherman, and he taught me.
Okay. All right, and here, how this is integrated into the story. He says, so anyway, he's, and for me, and for my ear at least, this four-count rhythm that he talks about is very evident in the fiction that is worked out. I'll show you how this one is. It was an art, and it's an art form. It's not just functional. All right, it was an art that was on a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock. As a Scot and a Presbyterian, my father believed that man was by nature a mess. And you know, just your fly line can be a mess. And had fallen from an original state of grace. Somehow I early developed the notion that he had done this by falling from a tree. As for my father, I never knew whether he believed God was a mathematician, but he certainly believed God could count. And only by picking up God's rhythms were we able to regain power and beauty. Unlike many Presbyterians, he often used the word beautiful. And I always remember this about McLean, because that could be such an overused word. It's such a common word. But in this text, it's beautiful. And I don't know how he does that. But I know when I get student papers, if I would try and write, and how, what do you think the mountains are? Oh, they're beautiful. Well, wow, you know, that's original. But there's something about the way he says it with rhythm or precision. You know, it's just right on. Well, it's just like a good cast.
Yeah, and then also the contrast of, you know, a culture in which it wouldn't be said.
Yeah.
And then pulling it out as
a
jump.
So, okay, so this is how we have this tension. So you're here, and we're a great place to learn this. We're here in just this expansive, sumptuous, almost impossible to describe, so beautiful environment here. And then you have this rigid Presbyterian minister. You know, what's man's chief end, you know, to serve God? And, you know, you have this rigorous, strict education, and there's this strict rhythm as to how you're even to catch fish. But this is the grace part. Until man is redeemed, he will always, and this is interesting, talk to me about this flycaster. Until man is redeemed, he will always take a fly rod too far back, just as natural man always overswings with an axe or golf club and loses all his power somewhere in the air. Only with a rod, it's worse, because the fly often comes so far back, it gets caught behind in a bush or a rock. When my father said it was an art that ended at 2 o'clock, he often added closer to 12 than to 2, meaning that the rod should be taken back only slightly farther than overhead, straight ahead being 12 o'clock. But anyway, he associates this with humankind being redeemed. What do you know about, you know, overcasting? Does this logically make any sense to those of you who know something about fly fishing in terms of how you approach life? You buy into this?
Huh? It's a boundary you're always pushing.
Okay.
And when you go, and you know that bush is there.
Uh-huh.
And but you're pushing those limits.
Yeah.
Because you want to get out a little bit farther into that hole. And then when you snag that fly on the tree behind you and lose a nice fly, then you're pretty upset with yourself.
So does this have something to do with our lack of grace?
Well, it also sounds like a lack of discipline.
Lack of grace is certainly in casting, but does it have something to do, you know, spiritually with our lack of grace? Mm-hmm. You think? You overcast?
If the greatest rewards are staying within a certain boundaries by, you know, learning to
perfect the technique within those boundaries, you know, that if that's like God's goal for us, really, then you catch the most fish and your most abundant life or whatever. But we think that we know better, so we tend to try too hard.
Okay.
Yeah, and it seems to mirror sort of the way he speaks about his father and the way his childhood is sort of this strict childhood that's enforced by his father and the discipline his father gives to him. He can't run around and play with the rest of the boys freely during the day. He has to wait until he gets his assignment just perfect. The itinerary for a Sunday is very set and rigid, and you know, his father won't let him go fish right away and catch a couple fish as he and his brother would like to do. They have to learn how to do it just right first. And it's all sort of mirrored within this. I think she hit right on that, you know, we have to live within, if we can teach ourselves, if we can discipline ourselves to live within these certain guidelines, then that's what in the end will make us the best fishermen.
Yeah.
And also where the beauty is.
And also where the beauty is in terms of the art.
And the piece around, you know, where natural man, he says, overcast or whatever. I was thinking about, we've been teaching, our daughter's trying to learn how to play basketball. And most of the mistakes she makes are that she overshoots. Uh-huh. It's not that she undershoots, it's that her anxiety and her urging and enthusiasm, she overshoots.
It's
almost like trying too hard or losing focus. To me, that's about. And when you try too hard or you lose focus, you get a field. You go on a tangent rather than get where your goal is.
So it's simple, but good advice for us that has lots of. Yeah. Okay. Is this book about fly fishing, or even about this father and his son? No, what's the book about? It's about his brother, about his family relations. And I took this book out of my library, just packed it, and I read it yesterday. When I opened it up, I saw this inside. And I was so touched by that because one of the guys I read about, one of my former profs, mailed this to me, Glenn Kolb, who's still alive. And he knows I'm interested in McLean. And I had some letters from him that that I have given to the Regenstein Library. And Glenn Kolb was active he has them right now. And I don't know what he's doing with them. But anyway, they're for free. They're going to the Regenstein. But he gave me this picture about Paul's death, his brother Paul's death. And I can pass this around and you can read it while we're talking about this novel, but it's fascinating. And the story here is, first of all, we're talking about the Scots Presbyterian minister and his family, and we're talking about fly fishing. But what's the tension in the story, in the family? Anybody remember? How many of you have read this book recently?
I just saw the movie. Yeah.
Oh, you saw the film?
Yeah, I saw the film. Yeah.
Well, you certainly see that there's some tension with the son of that film. Don't get me on that film. In here, he has two sons. All right, so it's McLean and his brother. And when you read this, it seems as though you're reading a true story. And a lot of it is true. He did live in Sealy Lake. He did, you know, do many of the things in here. But he's also changed information around. What happens is that Paul resists certainly the grace that his father would like to offer in terms of spirituality. But who's the best fly fisherman? Who's the absolute ultimate in fly fisherman? It's his brother Paul. And you can just see with his wrist, and there's a lot of talk, there are a number of references in the novel about his wrist. But anyway, Paul gets into trouble. And McLean is as much of a maverick as he was at Chicago compared to his brother. He was more conventional, even in real life. His brother, very early on, he was a journalist. He was a hard drinker. He was a brawler. And he was a gambler, okay? So I don't know the whole story, but he did make his way to Chicago, where, and lived very close. He lived in Ingleside. The book tells you the address, which is very close to where Norman McLean was living in Hyde Park there too. I mean, within blocks, they lived together. I mean, they lived near each other. And he was working on a newspaper. He became a journalist for one of the Chicago papers, and you can see there, there's a picture of a woman there, and I think she was a sports writer there. They were lovers, I would assume from that. But anyway, he got into trouble, and one night, McLean was awakened, knock at the door really late at night while you're sleeping, and found out that his brother had been killed and found in an alley. He was beaten to death. And so then his parents were still alive, and he had to tell his father, and that was really hard. But anyway, this story has to do with, and if you talk to McLean even in his 80s, and I knew him, I was lucky enough to be able to have some conversations with him from time to time, and he would still get tears in his eyes when he talked about the death of his brother. I mean, that was still a real concern. And I know what he's concerned about was exactly what's in this book, of how he could communicate. So how do they communicate? They go fishing. And the same kind of dynamics happens. Here you've got this tough, rugged, hard-drinking, brawling guy, and he's not about to, what we would talk about today, is share our, you know, feelings. This just isn't something that's going to happen between the two of them. But let me show you in the book what does happen and how this is at work with the way they communicate. On page 13, you don't, well, you have your text with you, but page, if you're with me, you can turn to page 13. And he says, Paul's telling these stories, and you have to remember too, in terms of what's on the surface and what lies beneath, or layers of meaning in a text, whatever way you like to approach this. He's telling a story, and you don't know if it's Paul. Personal story, if it's a story about somebody whom he's writing on, or if it's a story that he's made up, or if it's a mix of all this. So anyway, he told his continental divide stories. It's just at the bottom of the page, Gabe. He told his continental divide stories in a seemingly lighthearted, slightly poetical mode, such as reporters often use in writing human interest stories. But if the mood were removed, his stories would appear as something about him that would not meet the approval of his family, and that I probably would find out about in time anyway. So, he's not going to confess. He's not going to come right out and say, you know, I really got in trouble with drinking. I wrecked my car, and, you know, I've got a big fine to pay in jail because it threw me in jail. But But on the other hand, he lets Norman be privy to this because he figures, well, you're going to find out anyway, you're part of the family. So, you know, it's his way of roundabout telling him. So anyway, but they were poetic. And again, you have this notion of symmetry, of beauty, of how a story is told, such as reporters often use in writing human interest stories. But if the mood were removed, his stories would appear as something about him that would not meet the approval of the family, and that I would probably find out about this in time anyway. He also must have felt honor-bound to tell me that he lived other lives, even if he presented them to me as puzzles in the form of funny stories. Often I did not know what I had been told about him as we crossed the divide. And here we are up in the mountains, the divide between our two worlds. So anyway, that's already in page 13. Move over to 17, and you'll see more of this. They're out fishing now. I studied this situation. Although maybe I had just added 3 feet to my roll cast, and he can't cast nearly as well as his brother, but he's still a good fisherman. I still had to do a lot of thinking before casting to compensate for some of my other shortcomings. But I felt I had already made the right beginnings. I had already figured out where the big fish would be and why. Then an odd thing happened. I saw him. A black back rose and sank in the foam, and here, this is a fish. In fact, I imagined I saw spines on his dorsal fin until I said to myself, God, he couldn't be so big you could see his fins. I even added, you wouldn't even have the fish in all that foam if you hadn't thought he'd first be there. But I couldn't shake the conviction that I ate fish, because as someone often forced to think, I know that often I would not see a thing unless I thought of it first. So this whole book is interwoven with the kinds of things, you know, do you see this reality? Is this really happening? This big fish, what is it? Is it something that you can catch and land? Is it some way where I can really kind of hit pay dirt and finally communicate with my brother, who I know is in trouble, and who the sheriff's told me they've been picking him up too much lately. You know, he's been drinking too much. And he's in the big stud poker game, so he's in trouble. Am I going to land this big fish and help him? Or, you know, how am I going to do this? Or is this an illusion? So a lot of the tension in this book has to do with storytelling and fly fishing and what happens under these levels of what's lying under the surface. Also, he has this truly obnoxious brother-in-law. His name is Neil. He's the guy that arrives from California. He grew up in Montana, but he arrives from California, and he's wearing his tennis sweater, and he turns his profile to be kissed. Imagine these lumberjacks, how that went over. But anyway, and they have to put up with him, and they have to take him fishing, and even worse, this guy is a bait fisherman. You know, he has his Hills Brothers red coffee can with worms in it. So, I mean, it's the ultimate for them. But Paul is obviously, the brother Neil is obviously in trouble too, and Paul comments on this. He gets roped into taking this despicable character fishing, who McLean makes this wonderful comment about, it's really awful to have someone whom you despise with your wife's face. He must look like his wife. But anyway, they have to take him fishing. The women in the family want Norman to take him fishing, and Norman asks Paul to go along. And although Paul's having problems, he is very loyal. He's been out drinking and carousing all night long, but he's there in the morning waiting for Neil, who has also been out carousing and made the terrible mistake of going to this really hardtack bar that they had and bragging about all his feats. I can even tell you, oh, it's just so bad what he does. Let's see. And he takes up with old Rawhide, who's the town whore. But anyway, Paul says maybe he likes the idea of someone who's trying to help him. Maybe he likes that. And even if McLean doesn't particularly feel he's ever going to do anything or the guy's recoverable, he says maybe he likes being helped. So you have those references. I know some of you would also like to hear about Young Men in Fire, so I'll read you a few more things in this. And then we can talk a little bit about Young Men in Fire, too. In this book here, he makes a reference to Young Men in Fire. On page 47, there's an analogy to a storm coming in, and he sees this black cloud, and they are caught, you know, kind of between mountains in a deep valley there. The black cloud was taking over the canyon completely. The dimensions of the world were compressed to about 900 by 900 by 900, you know, 900, 900, 900. That's about what you could see. It must have been something like this in 1949 when the giant fire from Man Gulch, the the next gulch up from the Missouri where they're fishing swept over the divide into the Elkhorn. Man Gulch was where the Forest Service dropped 16 of its crack smoke jumpers, 13 of whom had to be identified later by their dental work. That's the way the storm came down the Elkhorn, about to obliterate it. So the storm is coming. And in 1949 was roughly 30, 35 years after this story is being told. But he's, you know, of course he's even older now, he's looking back. But he talks about this Man Gulch fire. And I'll get back to that in a moment, but that's early on in the text, just if we're looking through this text chronologically. Page 53, Gabe, you have him describing this bear going over the mountain. Now, oh no, it's 55. If you've ever, and here again is an example of McLean style. If you've ever seen a bear go over a mountain, if you have never seen a bear go over the mountain, you have never seen the job reduced to its essentials. Of course, deer are faster, but not going straight uphill. Not even elk have the power in their hind quarters. Deer and elk zigzag and switch back and stop and pose while really catching their breath. The bear leaves the earth like a bolt of lightning, retrieving himself and making its thunder backward. So there's an example of, again, simple language economy. And for me, at least, the style, the form relates to the meaning because, you know, his own writing is economical. I mean, it's the bare essentials. Almost a pun on it, but there he does it. If you've never seen a bear go over the mountain, you have never seen the job reduced to its essentials. See, I love stuff like this. And I absolutely love writing that is so powerful and economical. You know, Henry James is somebody I admire. I mean, Faye was just reading, what, The Ambassadors? And, you know, I'm reading Agatha Christie, and I'm supposed to teach Lit and Faye's reading Henry James. And, you know, I admire Henry James, but I don't love him. All right. So he's talking, he has this conflict with his wife. Because, you know, they think they left this brother who lies right through his teeth about, you know, they actually come there to take him fishing, and the guy's so hungover, and he's got this whore with him, and so he just he just basically lays down and won't go fishing with him. Well, then he gets sunburned, and he comes back, and the women are all worried, and they think that Norman and Paul just dropped him off and let him get sunburned, and so on and so on. And finally that gets sorted out, and McLean says he drove off after he and Jesse came back to an understanding, feeling lordly with love. Lordly with love. But anyway, I'll move toward the end. The book is only 104 pages long, and a lot of stuff happens in there. He has to, in the end, tell his father that his brother was found murdered. In this story here, it's in Montana. And so whatever communication they tried with fishing, or these layers of meaning, in the end, nothing really landed the way he had hoped it would. So, but they're always talking about this guy's hand and the way he can fish, and there's some great scenes in this novel if you love fly fishing, you know how this goes. But anyway, the emphasis is on the strength and the artistry in that hand. So when he's killed, this is what the father says. Okay, I'll read you this passage because it's beautiful. A river, though, has so many things to say that it is hard to know what it says to each of us. As we were packing our tackle and fishing the car, Paul repeated, "Just give me 3 more years." At the time, I was surprised at the repetition, but later I realized that the river somewhere, sometime, must have told me too, that he would receive no such gift. For when the police sergeant, early next May, waked me before daybreak, I rose and asked no questions. Together we drove out across the Continental Divide and down the length of the Big Blackfoot River, over forest floors yellow and sometimes white with glacier lilies, to tell my father and mother that my brother had been beaten to death by the butt of a revolver and his body dumped in an alley. My mother turned and went to her bedroom. My mother turned and went to her bedroom. We're in a house full of men and rods and rifles. She had faced most of her great problems alone. She was never to ask me a question about the man she loved the most and understood the least. Perhaps she knew enough to know that for her it was enough to have loved him. He was probably the only man in the world who had held her in his arms and leaned back and laughed. When I finished talking to my father, he asked, "Is there anything else you can tell me?" Finally, I said, "Nearly all the bones in his hand were broken." And so what that means is he died fighting. So, and that's a comfort to his Presbyterian minister father, that he died fighting. So anyway, in the end, he says, Father asked, "After you had finished your true story sometime, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it?" This is what he's done. "Only then will you understand what happened and why. It is those we live with in love and should know who elude us." Here's the final few paragraphs. "Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman. And now, of course, I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then in the arctic half-light of the cannon, all existence fades to a being with my soul and memories of the sounds of the Big Blackfoot River in a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will still rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the woods, and some of the woods are theirs. I am haunted by the waters." So he wrote that when he was 70, when his wife Jessie died. And then after that, there were issues with the film. William Hurt came by and wanted to play his brother. And William Hurt was, you know, he's pretty famous at that time even. And Norman said no, because he was out at Sealy Lake and the guy couldn't fly cast right. And plus he was afraid, his greatest concern was that his family would be vilified. That was, I mean, I've heard him say that over and over with his struggle with his film. And finally, Robert Redford called, and he flew down to the Sundance Institute and managed to persuade him that the family would not be vilified and that the film, and so that's kind of the story behind the film. If you see in the credits the word Schneider, those are the grandkids. The one who's the piano player is one of Gene and Joel Schneider's sons, and the other one who's in the newsroom who brings in news. Those are the McLean grandchildren. And they were out here making that film too, and there are all kinds of stories about those kids. Not all of them good. But anyway, he struggled with that. He has two children. Jean is a lawyer. They both graduated from the University of Chicago. She's been the editor of the law school journal at the University of Chicago. She's not doing that anymore. And his son John is one of the major writers for the Chicago Tribune, one of the major editors. So the children have carried on that profession. Young Men in Fire, we've got some time for that. The little I can tell you a little bit about what was going on when he wrote it, because I knew him at that time, and he had this tension with his film, and also he was trying to get this story down, and it was at a time in his life where his health was declining. And he didn't have a computer, he didn't have word wrap, all this was written out by hand, and he just had a great difficulty collecting his thoughts and getting his story down. So he died when he was 88 or 89, right in there. So when he was in his 80s, he was still struggling with this. And as probably some of you know, Young Men in Fire was published after he died. And so other people worked on that manuscript. And he won, after he died, he won a Pulitzer for nonfiction for it. But there was just a tremendous struggle in his mind. It caused him tremendous anxiety toward the end of his life when he wanted to write that story and get it done. So you want to talk? It's beautifully written, too. It's nonfiction. Have you read it, Whitey? And who has read Young Men in Fire in here? Okay. And you attended Chicago, too, right?
Yeah. It was the best book I'd read in ages, and it's a detective story.
Okay,
with him as the detective.
Yeah.
He decides he wants to find out exactly what happened, what mistakes were made that 13 of 16 firefighters would be killed within 15 minutes of being dropped into the area. Mm-hmm. They're dropped into a totally clear area, and they're dead in 15 minutes. And he can't find out. There's all these barriers to his finding out what the truth was, because there had been a lawsuit, a wrongful death lawsuit, brought by some of the families of the people that died. And the Forest Service, which I guess is well known for this, buried all of the information they had, hid it, destroyed it, put it in a different file and mislabeled it.
Yeah.
And so he can't find the actual reports that were brought in. And then he goes to try to track down the survivors and has a great deal of trouble, and finally finds one or two survivors. The central character in the mystery, the guy who's in charge of that group of people, has died of cancer long ago, and so we can't talk to him. But he does finally figure out the mystery. Mm-hmm. And he talks about what went wrong, and really what went wrong was the leader was brilliant and knew what he was doing, but the crew had never worked together.
Yeah.
And so when they are suddenly engulfed by this fire that they didn't know was coming, and I think when you read about the forest fires now where firefighters are losing their lives, like the one around here, there isn't any way to predict. All of a sudden there's a blow-up, and that's it. And the leader did everything right, however, because the crew had never worked together, the people in the crew that were seasoned weren't about ready to listen to what this guy said, because this guy was trying to get them to do something revolutionary. And McLean thinks that on the spot, the guy came up with the idea of a rescue fire, which is you light a fire and lay down in its ashes. And so he thinks the guy was, has great admiration for the guy. But the story of how he finds out what he can find out from the Forest Service is phenomenal. And I started reading the book because somebody told me my uncle was in it. Mm-hmm. And it was just, McLean writes so well, it was just like I met my uncle in this book. I turn a page and there's Uncle Arthur coming down the stairs. He's the guy who was running the fire lab for Montana at the time. He throws in there those stories about things that happened to him when he was younger. And one of the things he says is the firefighters will talk about fighting a class 2 fire. And he says all the fires he fought when he was 18 were whatever the highest class was, because you could never get men and equipment there in time to stop it until it was huge. And there is one story in there that still haunts me. That's the story of when he's young, he's fighting a fire, and there's a blow up, and he's trying to outrun the fire, and he's running up a hill, and there's an old guy, looks like an old rummy guy, kind of. They picked up a lot of alcoholics to come and help fight with the fires, and who's up at the top, kind of waiting for him. And he finally gets up to the guy, and the guy socks him and knocks him backwards down the hill, and then turns and runs. And after that, McLean always wonders, did that really happen? Did I just hallucinate that? Why would somebody do something like that? And I thought, that's kind of one of the mysteries about human beings. I think it happened. I think somebody did that, and just,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
just for whatever wacko reason to try to kill somebody. I guess the other thing was, when he gets towards the end of the fire, he talks about, he goes back and walks over the Man Gulch area, and somebody else's investigator before him did it also. And you can tell at that point that he's dying.
Yeah.
It's mostly because his thoughts keep going back to, oh, here's this hill that was named for my wife. Oh, here's this that was my wife, and oh, and I remember when my wife said this. And as he's going forward in the story, he's going backwards with his memory. It's phenomenal. That's all.
Well, thank you so much for telling us. Yeah. Said you told it so well. Why?
Let's go back to this Forest Service and the fact that we couldn't find the story, or the true story. And I'm going to tell you what happened today and what absolutely happened to me and many, many more men. If you want to go back and find your records, military records, and even if you're hospitalized, no matter what you were, and for no matter what reason it is, they will always tell you that your records were burned in St. Louis. Now, I'm talking about World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam people. And they'll go back and maybe, I don't know for what reason, doesn't matter what reason it was, you see. And those records exist. They always tell you they were burned. But if you pursue it long enough, you will find that your records are in Connecticut. And a great big company has all those records. And if you hunt and force the issue, you will finally find your military records. Interesting. And it takes a long, long time. So if your arm got cut off and you want, you know, some compensation or something, it's going to be years before you get your first book. I'll tell you that for sure. Isn't that quite interesting? Mm-hmm. Why is it all that?
I don't know. And I don't know if that's parallel to what happened with the records in Montana.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, maybe we can ask our librarian friend here what happens with records sometimes, you know? Are they destroyed because they take up too much shelf space, or?
Well, I don't know, because we don't deal with records, we deal with published material.
Okay.
But there's the whole hoo-ha in San Francisco about the San Francisco Library throwing out the books, and Nicholas Baker saying what a travesty that was. But there are books written on the fact that records are mislaid.
Well, just within 2 weeks, I read about a Vietnam man, you know, trying to find his records. And so I got his name, and the city was in. I called him, and I told him, just keep going, boy, you'll find it. You've got to get, the Foreign Legion and those involved.
Mm-hmm.
It takes.
You're crying out loud.
Well, your congressman, he's dead.
The older he got, the more, you know, his health started to trouble him. And what he says here, that some of my friends think I shouldn't fish alone, that was starting to go on at that time, much less drive a car down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, not only was he having difficulty just getting the writing down, but he was having trouble with research. And that was before internet. I mean, it was like 10 years before all this started to arise. And I doubt, you know, he could have gotten a librarian to help him with internet, but I doubt if at his age he'd want to be attuned to those kinds of search engines. it's interesting to see him physically. I talk about him being in frailer health. But when he was in his 80s, that's when I got to know him as a student at Chicago. He was emeritus and professor, but I was lucky enough to get to know him then. And if you could see his body, the way he was built, he was an old man. But he had a very clean cut body. And he wasn't, you know, he was about my height. I'm 5'9". And so, as a lot of older people are in their 80s, the flesh kind of comes off. They're almost a little bit more shrunken. But it was interesting to see, just to watch his body, because he just had these very clean movements. And although he wasn't a big, brawny guy, you could see his shoulders were really powerful and his hands. You could see that those could have been the hands of a logger. These were not the hands of a college professor.
How did he, do you have a clue how he developed his love of literature from his background? How did that happen?
Oh, we talked about that a number of times, and it had very much to do with reading out loud and just like for those of us who love to read. Look at all the people here. Yes, well, they had a staff meeting yesterday and went around the room. One of the questions was, what's your favorite rainy day activity? I've never been in a place before in my life, including Augustana College, where everybody would say reading. I love to sit down and read. But just with that, if, whether you were on the dish crew or whether you were building a bridge or what, that's what everybody loved to do. And I think that there was something about that era and time. They didn't have TV. And he just had a natural affinity for reading and literature. His father certainly saw to it that he read. They had a library. Oh, they had a whole library in their home, yeah. And at Seeley Lake. But I think early on in his life, he had a love for that. And certainly with writing, his, you know, Paul was a writer too. So they had that. They were scholars at heart out in the wilderness.
His father had vision too, to say, I will send you to any college that you can get into. I mean, that's pretty good.
I'm saving money.
Yeah.
In other words, if you do the study, boy, you know, I'm saving enough money for you to get anywhere you want to go. And he did. I don't know why he chose Dartmouth.
Because there's girls there.
Yeah, but he married a Montana girl.
Oh, well.
Was there somebody maybe on staff, do you think?
Pardon?
Do you think there was, that he seems like the person that would really look at that decision, and I'm just wondering if there was maybe somebody who went to study with him.
I don't know what the story is behind there. That one I never heard. I think there's somebody who's writing biography of him now. I'd be real anxious to hear.
Someone in Chicago?
Yes. In fact, she's going to get those letters for a while. That's why they haven't gone directly to the library yet. I guess, I don't know what the story is behind that, but there's something about the curator of the library, I mean, who owns what. And I wouldn't be here if it weren't for some of the folks at Chicago and people like Norma McLean. So I can't imagine selling his letters. He'd roll in his grave. But there's, who gets the letters, who gets the information first? You know how scholars can scrap about things like that. So I don't know, but Gwen Kolb is somebody, he's in his 80s too, you know, and he's a book collector. He's a Johnsonian scholar. They don't know what he's teaching that century anymore, I don't think, but he has a lot of rare books, so he was the right person to ask. And plus he's a kind, honorable man, and I know he loved Norm McLean, so he has those letters. His wife's had some surgeries and such, and they had to move because she's not as mobile as she was, so I don't know what's happened, but there's something in terms of scholarship, but I'm pretty sure the person who was writing that biography might like to read some of those letters that he wrote, too, especially if she can read them, because his handwriting was so bad when he got old. But I always was kind of in awe of him, and he had been very kind to me. And So I knew he drank whiskey, so I know one Christmas I bought him a bottle of Yukon Jack. Because I didn't know, at the time, I didn't know anything about whiskey. I should have bought him a single malt scotch, now I know that. But so I got him a bottle of Yukon Jack because the name seemed right for him. And I'm sure he realized that, you know. But he would still walk a lot, and he was a bird watcher. And one of the other things this guy did, too, that was interesting is they had a round table called Stump the Scholars on television. He was really interested in baseball, and I've forgotten who his scholarly buddy at Chicago was who did this, but anyway, the two of them were on this televised program where they'd sit across the table to two, like Lou Boudreau, or I don't know, whoever knows all kinds of things about baseball in that era. And there would be questions. It'd be kind of like a quiz show to see who knew what. And it was trying to stump the scholars. So he was on that. He could get pretty testy, I guess. But anyway, great writer. Interesting, colorful character. You know, certainly an interesting topic for us here. You know, it's a little hard to talk about these things if you haven't read, you know, the books, and particularly if you hadn't read them recently. So, but anyway, I hope that this will fire your interest to pick up a copy. I tell you one thing, when I read this thing yesterday, I was just struck again about how beautifully it was written. I just loved sitting there yesterday reading this. It was so beautiful. So pick it up. It's only 102 pages. And then there are those stories in the back, too, that are pretty raucous. So we could talk about them later. Anyway, I'm going to let you go. It's time to leave. I think Friday, I'm going to talk about Emily Dick. Is it Thursday today?
Yeah.
Friday, I'll be passing out some poems, and you'll actually be able to read them right in class. And I'll be talking a little bit about Dickinson on Saturday. If anybody's around, I'm going to be talking about something completely different. Faye and I are on the radio. We have a little radio program, public radio, that's connected with our college, and she interviews folks, and it's called About Books. And she's going to interview Julian because he buys books for Amazon and knows all kinds of stuff we don't know about books. And I write a history of words, so I'll be talking something about that on Saturday. Excruciating history of dentistry. For that pleasant thought, we'll see you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I've got a question.
Yeah.
Did you ever...